you know, we should always be doing everything we can to ensure that children are safe. We should also be doing everything we can to ensure that families have the supports and services they need to be able to safely care for their children.
Welcome to Talking About Kids. I am your host, R. Bradley Snyder, researcher, activist, and author of The Five Simple Truths of Raising Kids. Child maltreatment is a major public health concern here in the United States. But are the mandated reporting laws that were intended to reduce child maltreatment working? My guests this episode, Rachel Rosenberg and Sarah Catherine Williams, are two of the authors of a new report from Child Trends. As you will hear, their research suggests that mandated reporters need better training to help make the system more effective and to reduce stigmatizing families who are experiencing financial insecurities. This podcast is sponsored in part by the Arizona Department of Health Services Must Stop Bullying campaign through its Title V Maternal and Child Health Program. For more information, go to muststopbullying.org. And now, the interview.
My work in child welfare started several years ago, probably about a decade now, working with adults who had aged out of foster care and were at the time currently experiencing homelessness or incarceration. Hmm. And this led me to work with young people ages 14 to 26 who were either currently in the foster care system or formerly in the foster care system. And I did that for several years and still have a large body of work focused with that population. And over the years, I started thinking about the best way to prevent young people from aging out of care or leaving the foster care system at 18 or 21 without having been reunited with their families or adopted or entered into a guardianship arrangement. And I started thinking about the best way to prevent aging out of care, and it made me think that maybe the best way was preventing young people from having to enter foster care in the first place, which led me to then start exploring more about different reasons why young people and children enter the foster care system, different interventions and resources available to families, and started to explore that a little bit more, which then led me to this partnership with my co-author, Sarah Catherine Williams, Valerie Martinez, and Jachelle Ball.
And Sarah Catherine, tell me a little bit about the history of your interest in child safety and well-being.
Yeah, well, for me, it goes back to when I was a teacher, I always say in a former life. I was a special education teacher for Atlanta Public Schools, and I mostly did like small group instruction with my students and, you know, worked with the same kids year after year, so I got to know my students really well. And I had a couple of students who were in foster care, you know, a couple of kids who lived in group homes, and, you know, one who was in an informal kinship care arrangement. And, you know, I learned a lot about their experiences and, you know, how the child welfare system works, and really saw how what was going on in their home life was impacting them at school. So, you know, fast forward to when I was in graduate school getting a master's in social work, I had the opportunity to do research in the child welfare space. And, you know, I thought back to my students and wondered, you know, if their families could have been better supported, like outside of the child welfare system. And, you know, I strongly believe that all children deserve to feel safe and secure and, you know, and loved. And so, you know, I think our work at Child Trends, you know, provides the opportunity to, you know, promote those kinds of practices and policies that can help make that a reality. So, and that pairs a lot with, you know, Rachel's interest as well. So when this opportunity came up to look at mandated reporting policies and whatnot, as a way of, you know, how can we maybe get these families some help in other ways And, you know, when I was a mandated reporter as a teacher, you know, thinking, what were my other options? You know, if I saw a child that was in, you know, had some sort of a need. So it was kind of like a blending of different parts of my career, I guess. So.
You know, I'm so interested in this idea of mandated reporting, partially because the first time that I was told that I was a mandated reporter, my first contact with that was, you know, as a very young man, early 20s. And I thought, I bought maybe hook, line, and sinker that it was this very liberating thing, that it was this set of policies that kind of freed me of my responsibility to make judgment calls and really could just focus on and promote the, you know, the safety and well-being of children. But let's talk a little bit about what mandated reporting policies are. And I suspect that a lot of my audience knows and are mandated reporters. But one of the things that I hadn't thought about until I read your paper was not only what those policies are in general, but how they vary by state. So can you, in very general terms, explain what mandated reporting policies are and the different ways that they vary?
Yeah. So before we kind of get into the details of mandated reporting policies, I do, you know, you mentioned your listeners probably have a, you know, are interested in children and, you know, may have a good, you know, a general idea. I do want to take a step back and you just kind of make sure that we have a common understanding of like how a child, how the child welfare system works and, you know, kind of how a case moves through the system real quickly. So, you know, in general, we think there are kind of these four, you know, phases of a child welfare case where, you know, a report is made and it's either screened in or screened out. There's an investigation done and then the child welfare agency responds accordingly, you know, through supportive services or if it's warranted, by bringing children into foster care. And, you know, about a quarter of the children who receive an investigation are brought into the child welfare system and brought into foster care. And for families with an open child welfare case, you know, the agency then develops a case plan. And, you know, that is going to, that plan, you know, outlines for that family the conditions that would be necessary for the children to be reunited with their parents. Because that is the goal, is to get kids back home, you know, with their families. So, but the policies, you know, that determine exactly how a child welfare agency responds to allegations of maltreatment are going to be different in every state. So it's not just who's a mandated reporter, but even how they define maltreatment is going to be different in every state. Federal law identifies, you know, general parameters for what constitutes maltreatment, but then every state, you know, writes their own, you know, policies and definitions of what maltreatment is to be in compliance with those federal laws. So I think that's another really important contextual factor for people to understand is that a family living in one state is going to experience the child welfare system in a different way than a family, you know, and with the exact same circumstances that's living in a different state. And that's true with mandated reporting policies. Who's a mandated reporter is different in every state. So all states have some kind of mandated reporter policy. It's required by federal law, by the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which we call CAPTA. But those policies, again, they're going to be different in every state. Mandated reporters in general are, you know, usually they're people who are required or the way we define a mandated reporter is they're a person who's required by law to report suspected maltreatment. And usually there are people who come into contact with children as a part of their profession. So, you know, doctors, teachers, law enforcement. And, you know, since the passage of CAPTA, the law I was talking about, states have continued to broaden their policies of who is required to report suspected maltreatment. And in some states, it's everybody, like all adults. There are 17 states that have what are called universal mandated reporting policies where all adults have to report suspected maltreatment. And other states have, you know, gone on to add training requirements for mandated reporters and, you know, penalties for failure to report. You know, it runs the gamut. You know, a lot of times new policies are introduced in reaction to certain things, you know, high profile instances in the news and, you know, things like that. So, but what we did in our study, one of the things we did was trying to figure out if there are patterns among states in terms of the types of mandated reporting policies they have. You know, if there are different policy profiles, if you will, but, you know, we didn't necessarily find any patterns like that, which tells us that states are passing and implementing these mandated reporting laws and policies kind of in isolation. So, so it's just kind of a little willy-nilly, if you will. They're not necessarily thinking, you know, how do these policies interact with one another?
Well, and of course, a lot of your analysis focuses on a distinction between maltreatment and neglect, right? And so in recognizing that these things get defined not only differently by each state, but by each regime within each state. So when you have a new head of CPS, they'll put in new emphases. In general terms, Rachel, how did you make a distinction between maltreatment and neglect in your analysis?
Yeah, so our analysis does a few things, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail. One of the ways that we kind of differentiated between neglect and maltreatment was looking at in the data, it will tell us the reason that a child was reported to the hotline. And so we know a little bit about kind of broadly how they've coded that entry. We don't know any of the specifics, which does make it a little hard. There's a lot of nuance in child welfare, and unfortunately, we don't have the details around kind of why it was determined neglect versus another form of maltreatment. But what we did is we categorized reports into three types. So we looked at reports that included neglect only, reports that included neglect and another form of maltreatment. So that could look like a case that was reported and included neglect and physical abuse, or neglect and sexual abuse. And then we looked at cases that we determined as non-neglect. And so they were reported for something completely unrelated to neglect, such as, you know, physical or sexual abuse. And there are some other kind of categories in that, which allowed us to then look at how are these policies, how's the relationship between each of these mandated reporting policies that Sarah Catherine mentioned and the rate of reports and likelihood of substantiation different based on the type of maltreatment that occurred, whether it was neglect and something else, or non-neglect.
Well, and I think this is so important to your conclusion. So to some of your conclusions. And so just for my listeners, what might somebody be witnessing in a child that would classify what they're seeing as maltreatment versus the type of things that might get classified as neglect? Because this, I think, is at the core of some of your recommendations and findings.
Well, and I'll jump in to talk a little bit about like how maltreatment and neglect are typically defined.
Yes.
And you know how those are different. So you know, maltreatment, as I said earlier, definitions are different in every state. But in general, you know, when we think of maltreatment as a bucket, you know, it's defined as an act or a failure to act that results in serious harm to a child or puts that child at imminent risk of serious harm. And those are things like, as Rachel was mentioning, when we categorized the reports during our analyses, we looked at, you know, neglect only, neglect plus something else, or, you know, abuse only. So the neglect is usually defined as like failure to provide, right? So whereas physical abuse, sexual abuse are acts of like commission, you're committing something, whereas neglect is typically defined as as a lack of something, an omission. So, you know, failure to provide for the basic care and needs of a child, All states include, and this is something else that for your listeners to be aware of, is that all states include some type of income-related factor in their definition of neglect. So when you think of all of those like inadequacies, inadequate food, inadequate clothing or shelter or medical care, all of those can be byproducts of poverty and economic hardship. So I think what's difficult for a lot of mandated reporters to understand is that difference between like a willful omission of something versus not being able to provide for their child because of, you know, financial or economic hardship. And, you know, another a common misconception is that the majority of maltreatment reports are for those more serious forms of harm and abuse, like physical or sexual abuse. But neglect is the most common type of maltreatment reported to hotlines, and it's by far the most common reason associated with entering foster care. And, you know, in 2021, 64% of children came into foster care with neglect as a contributing factor. And that's compared to 13% for physical abuse. So, you know, what a lot of times when we give that statistic to people, they're very surprised because, you know, you think, oh, Child Protective Services, we're, you know, coming to the aid of these children who are being physically harmed. But the majority of children who are in foster care, it's a result the majority of children who are coming into foster care, it's a result of neglect. And parental substance use is also up there in terms of, you know, one of the, that's the second most common entry reason.
The news stories that are out there, whenever a CPS or, for my listeners in Arizona, a DCS is in the news, it's typically because of a child who's in a placement or in a home and where nobody intervened, right? We don't get a lot of stories about somebody intervening unnecessarily. We get most news stories, at least anecdotally. I don't have any data around that. But anyway, at least anecdotally, it seems like the stories that we hear about are when nobody intervened and a child was in real physical danger. So a question I have for you and is, well, why do we care that there are all of these reports? What are the dangers of over-reporting?
Sure. And let me start by saying that, you know, to those cases that you're kind of referring to, any time that, you know, an intervention should have occurred and didn't, and a young person and a child is harmed, or, you know, unfortunately, you know, child fatalities do occur every year, is a horrific case. And we should, you know, we should always be doing everything we can to ensure that children are safe. We should also be doing everything we can to ensure that families have the supports and services they need to be able to safely care for their children. And to Sarah Catherine's earlier point, because the majority of cases are related to neglect, we're not hearing about, you know, the times, those egregious neglect cases. It's typically neglect that, you know, potentially could have been prevented if the family had been provided services. But to your question, we know that a high number of reports that are made every year are screened out right away, in that as soon as the hotline person takes the call, they deem it not a call needing an investigation or any further investigation. And we then know that of the proportion of reports that are screened in, meaning that someone else is going to pick up that report and look into it a little bit more, that not all of them are substantiated. Some of them now go into a system and get an alternative response. So there's some nuance there, but we do know that a high number of reports are not deemed child maltreatment. And this idea of a high number of unnecessary reports could create kind of a needle in a haystack issue, in that the child welfare systems across the country, we know, are under-resourced and understaffed right now. And so having an influx in reports can make it difficult for the system to then be able to prioritize which reports should be investigated, the time it takes to really investigate a report thoroughly and correctly, and then ultimately the ability to detect when any type of maltreatment has occurred. The kind of other piece to unnecessary reports is that they may lessen the public's trust in the child welfare systems, as investigations can be really traumatic for families, and unnecessary reports may increase the number of traumatic investigations that could otherwise have been avoided. For example, this could include reports that maybe could have been handled through a different system or by having a conversation with the parents, such as the need to send their child to school in weather appropriate clothing, or is there food in the home? And if not, you know, how can we support you in getting there? But like I said, on the other hand, mandated reporters are required to report any suspicion of maltreatment and should report when there are concerns of maltreatment. And so in our study, we are in no way arguing kind of against this idea of making sure that children are safe and that families are provided with services.
So I want to talk about that, this conclusion that a greater understanding of the conditions of poverty might reduce these unnecessary reports. Because in my head, I'm already spinning a little bit, just, you know, based a little bit on something that Sarah Catherine said, where if the conditions of neglect are precipitated by some income measure or lack of income measure, what we also know about reunification plans is that they often have some sort of mandate of certain basic needs being met. I'm worrying now that those, you know, that the child was reported for something that was related not to conditions in the home, but to conditions of income. And then they are being kept out of the home because of conditions of income. So let's talk about how a greater understanding of conditions of poverty might reduce these unnecessary reports.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad we're having the opportunity to have this discussion because it's very much at the forefront of a lot of people's minds in the child welfare field, and something that, you know, folks, I think from all sides are really grappling with. And, you know, to be clear, I want to make sure that people understand that the majority of parents that are living in poverty or experiencing economic hardship, they don't abuse or neglect their children, right? Like, being poor doesn't make you a bad parent. But the inclusion of so many of these income-related factors in the definition of neglect gives the impression that, you know, poor parents are neglectful parents. And, you know, whenever I'm speaking about maltreatment definitions, I always think about this quote by Dorothy Roberts, who wrote the book Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. I couldn't have said this in any better way, so I quote her all the time. But she says that, you know, maltreatment may be indirectly caused by parental poverty, detected because of parental poverty, or defined by parental poverty. And that's particularly true when it comes to neglect. And there's a growing movement to redefine neglect, you know, both at the state and national level. You know, we presented the results of our study to members of a group called the SPARK Network, which is a state policy and advocacy and reform center. You know, they're a group of advocates, child welfare advocates, that are focused on child welfare reform, and one of their priorities is trying to develop a, you know, kind of like a model definition of neglect. And at the federal level, they're talking about this. I attended a briefing last week on the Hill about how can we redefine and de-link poverty and child maltreatment. And, you know, if there were more resources, you know, Rachel touched on this a little bit already, that if there are more resources available to help families get what they need, you know, and those resources were easier to access, you know, we'd see fewer reports of neglect. And I mean, there's research that demonstrates, you know, that this is true. And, you know, we know, for, you know, that increasing the minimum wage and expanding Medicaid, those are both associated with reductions in neglect reports. Like there's, you know, there's evidence that that's true. But, you know, right now there's still this push and pull between, you know, accepting poverty as a societal failure or is it an individual failure? And, you know, right now, you know, it's seen more as an individual personal failure. And so, you know, there's just a lot of tension there. But, you know, until we're able to get families what they need, you know, and whatever that looks like, you know, is to that family's individual needs. I don't know. There's just a great need to try and to increase the number of economic supports that are available to families just to get them what they need.
And I'm seeing so many parallels. I mean, there's so many follow-up questions I have right now, partially because I'm seeing a parallel with this and what happened in what we used to call homeless families, and we shifted to an unhoused or an underhoused population, moving the blame and the stigma associated with that blame. Is there a movement that you're aware of to change how we talk about neglect, to move it from a word that is absolutely a judgment on the primary care provider to a label that reflects a condition that exists within that community?
I would say there is a movement. I participated in a two-day convening last week with APHSA, which it's going to take me a second to make sure I get their acronym right. It's the American Public Human Services Association. And they held a two-day convening of advocates, persons, lived experience leaders, so people who have experienced the child welfare system in various different ways, and, you know, former agency administrators and folks from states, you know, state-level child welfare agencies as well. And, you know, the whole point of that two-day meeting was to try and come up with policy recommendations for how we can, right, you know, narrow the front door to child welfare. And, you know, rethinking how we define neglect as part of that, but also how can all human services agencies, not just child welfare agencies, but how can all agencies come together to support families? And, you know, in every state, the way those types of, you know, public benefits or safety net programs, you know, they may fall under the same agency umbrella as the child welfare agency, or they may be separate, but until they, all of those systems can work together to support families, you know, child welfare is often it's like the emergency room, right? Like, right, if you get to child welfare, everything else has failed. And so there's also a parallel with that, with like our healthcare system, right? If you, you know, the child welfare is the emergency room, but, you know, Department of Housing or, you know, our healthcare system or all of these other systems should be intervening and helping these families before they get to this crisis point, which is the point in which they enter child welfare. So it's definitely a system reform effort. But there are lots of states that are really looking into this as well. New York, Colorado, I think we could list off lots of different states.
Well, to that point, and because one of your recommendations from this paper, there's going to be a link, by the way, to your paper for those who haven't had a chance to read it, that you produced with Child Trends, is that, you know, you were advocating for, like I said, a greater understanding of the conditions of poverty and how those impact families. Have you seen this done well? Is there a system or a bureau within a system that is really doing a good job of making sure that its staff, maybe that its mandated reporters, are able to tease out the difference between what we think of or what we want to make sure a child is protected from? And, well, okay, I'm taking that back because I want to protect children from all sorts of poverty, but the difference between this maltreatment and conditions of poverty.
I mean, I know I had the pleasure last week of speaking to some folks from New York State about how they're trying to like narrow the front door to the child welfare system. And part of that is rethinking their approach to mandated reporting, not necessarily their what's written in their statutes, but just more of like that, trying to build a more of a supportive relationship with mandated reporters. And, you know, part of it has been a messaging shift where their messaging to mandated reporters used to be when in doubt report. But now they're shifting to a message of you don't have to report a family to be able to support that family. And so the intent is to, you know, partner with mandated reporters to try and mitigate the impact of poverty and racial inequality by linking families to community resources and preventative services. And, you know, they've revamped their training for mandated reporters, which was in alignment with our findings and one of our recommendations. I mean, to be clear, they were doing this before reading our report. But they have revamped their training to try and focus on how mandated reporters can counter implicit bias and understand adverse childhood experiences. And they've developed a checklist for mandated reporters to use when deciding, is this something that I need to report, or can we better, you know, support these families in some other way? And they've established a warm line where they can refer, you know, it's staffed by representatives to assist families by identifying local resources and just trying to get them connected to, you know, food and clothing and housing and childcare and things like that. So there are definitely ways, you know, to, you know, while we understand that mandated reporting is necessary, thinking how can we do mandated reporting better? And so that was, I thought that was a really good example of how, you know, changing your messaging, changing up how you're doing your training can be helpful.
And we're seeing this idea of moving from hotlines to warm lines start to happen across the country. So there's several states who are moving in that direction with the hope that when mandated reporters are calling in, if they can call into a warm line that can then help connect families to services rather than only routing them into the child welfare system, that potentially some issues could be resolved without ever needing to have a formal case opened with the child welfare system, which can have other consequences associated it. And then also hoping that warm lines may help beyond mandated reporters, and that it may give folks who aren't mandated reporters but have, you know, contact with children an avenue to help families versus having to call a hotline. I don't think, to my knowledge at least, we don't have a ton of research yet on if warm lines are helping and if some of these more innovative approaches are helping, because they're all fairly new in response to kind of changing trends over the last decade or so. But I do think we'll start to see more and more reforms across the country as states kind of grapple with how to handle this kind of conflation of poverty and neglect.
Well, and I really like that. And so, you know, what I'll say to listeners is to check on what's happening in your own community, advocate for these warm lines. I know that all of us have had discussions. If we haven't made that call ourselves, we know people who have. And we know that their goal in making that call was not to disrupt a family, was not to vilify somebody for being poor. It also, and we didn't get to talk about this today, was not to vilify somebody for being from a community of color, which is obviously impacted by this disproportionately. But the goal was to help a child. And if the warm line can accomplish that with less disruption to that family unit, that source of resilience, hopefully, then I think that that's going to satisfy the spirit of this law. But Rachel and Sarah Catherine, we could keep talking about this. I think it's such a really important topic. And I'm going to encourage all my listeners to keep investigating it, follow where this trend is going. But I also want to thank you and Child Trends once again for talking about things that not everybody wants to talk about, but absolutely need to be talked about if we're going to help kids. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, we appreciate the opportunity.
That was Rachel Rosenberg and Sarah Catherine Williams. For more information about Rachel, Sarah Catherine, and the report from Child Trends, please visit talkingaboutkids.com. From there, you also can find out about upcoming episodes, suggest a topic, learn more about me and my books, or submit your questions for future guests. Our theme song is by The Senators. For more of their music, go to thesenatorsmusic.com. And remember, kids are young goats and young humans. And the difference is that young goats are easier to make.